foreign minister summons Greece's charge d'affaires in protest and the seizure of an Iranian flag ship and its cargo in Greek waters. Iran's leader says Islamic Republic is constantly engaged in challenges with world powers since it disrupted equations of the hegemonic system. And the Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement says Israel's continued aggression against Al-Aqsa Mosque will cause the region to ignite. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Iran's foreign ministry summons Greece's charge d'affaires in protest of the seizure of an Iranian flagship and its cargo in Greek waters. Iran's foreign ministry, that is, has summoned Greece's charge d'affaires to convey Tehran's strong protest to Athens over the seizure of an Iranian flagship and its cargo. An Iranian foreign ministry official said that Greece seized the ship under illegal pressure from the United States. He said the vessel had stopped in Greek waters due to a technical glitch, and its seizure is against Athens' international obligations. The official said the seizure of the ship's cargo amounts to international piracy, holding the Greek government and those who illegally seized the cargo responsible. He said the Iranian government will not overlook its legal rights in this case and expects the Greek government to abide by its international obligations. Greece is holding the Iranian flag vessel in its waters. Its cargo has been seized in coordination with the U.S. government. Talks between Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal remain stalled over what Tehran calls Washington's failure to make political decisions, and now the U.S. has threatened to tighten sanctions on Iran if the deal is not restored. U.S. Special Envoy for Iran Robert Malley issued the threat during a congressional testimony. He said the prospects of reviving the accord are at best tenuous. He said the White House will continue to reject what it considers unreasonable demands from Tehran. Meanwhile, the U.S. Treasury has announced fresh sanctions on some individuals and entities for links to the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. The department claims that the IRGC leads an international oil smuggling and money laundering network. Iran has reiterated that the JCPOA revival hinges on verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions and guarantees that Washington will not abandon the deal again as it did back in May 2018. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says Iran has firmly stood against hostilities and enmities and continues to make progress. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei made the comments in a meeting with Iranian lawmakers. The leader said Iran and world powers are engaged in constant challenges in various dimensions because the Islamic Republic's new model, which is religious democracy, led to the disruption of the global hegemonic system. Ayatollah Khamenei also raised the alarm about the hostile stance of world powers and threats of those possessing atomic weapons. He added Europe is one of the most war-prone regions, which witnesses increased military provocations and war in its vicinity. Ayatollah Khamenei said such conditions, along with food shortages and an unprecedented spread of disease, have made the situation more complicated for other countries. Political commentator Fouad Izadi believes that the U.S. has seen substantial erosion in its hegemonic power because Iran has stood up to Washington's aggressive policies in the region.
So Iran has made sure that U.S. hegemony in Southwest Asia doesn't take root. Iran has been opposing U.S. aggressive policies in this part of the world. And that opposition that Iran has been engaging in has affected U.S. stance internationally. And it has contributed to the decline that we see in the United States. That has resulted in the fact that U.S. Has failed in its policies in Iraq, in Syria, in Lebanon, in Afghanistan, in Yemen, no matter where, in Iran, no matter where you look, the U.S. has failed. And that failure in this part of the world, I think, has resulted in people realizing that the U.S. is no longer a hegemonic power.
The Secretary General of Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has hailed the victory over Israel back in 2000, saying it was an unprecedented achievement for resistance. Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah was delivering an address marking the 22nd anniversary of the liberation of southern Lebanon from Israeli occupation. He said the victory thwarted the regime's project to create a greater Israel. The Hezbollah leader said Israel is a barbaric entity that only pretends to be civilized. Nasrallah said Hezbollah has been fighting to protect Lebanon and its people without ever having an intention to seize power. The Hezbollah leader added that resistance is not seeking or doesn't need to seek permission from anyone to protect the country. He also warned Israel about the continued aggression against the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Nasrallah said any aggression against Al-Aqsa or any other Muslim sanctity will cause the region to explode. Lebanon marked the Resistance and Liberation Day on May 25th and does so every year. Hezbollah forces drove Israel out of southern Lebanon back in May of 2000, ending over two decades of the regime's occupation.
May 25th marks the 22nd anniversary of Lebanon's liberation from the Israeli occupation, a national holiday seen by many in Lebanon as a true Independence Day. Dr. Nazia Saleh is from a small town on the southern border. She stressed that the Israeli aggressions began in 1948, but intensified in 1982 when Israel's invasion reached the capital, Beirut.
During the occupation, we were suffering a lot. We cannot go to our villages. Like, I'm from South Lebanon. I couldn't go to South Lebanon, to my village.
She recalls how in the early hours of the full-scale invasion, news of resistance operations began, and that the liberation would be the outcome, although hard to believe.
People, they didn't believe that. Nobody expected that Israel will withdraw. Israel, through history, when they occupy a land, they don't withdraw. They don't leave it because they are stealer. But what happened in Lebanon, it was a surprise. It was a very, very, very nice surprise. So people, till now, they don't believe what happened. But the answer is the resistance.
Israeli troops began their withdrawal on May 24, 2000. The masses marched to their hometowns and villages, forcing the Israeli collaborators to flee their positions. When the first rumors of an Israeli withdrawal spread, people from all areas rushed to the buffer zone. Many of those people's hometowns had been under occupation for more than 20 years. It was the people's spirit, along with continuous resistance operations, that secured the first ever unconditional withdrawal of the Israeli army since 1948. Former Lebanese detainees in Israeli jails say this liberation is the only national holiday that was truly Lebanese and paid for with so many sacrifices.
This is the only holiday we believe in, enforcing the Israeli enemy to withdraw with no agreement or preconditions is a historic and unprecedented event which we paid a heavy price for. With all the backing that this enemy had from the U.S. and the West, the resistance was capable of achieving this victory.
Hezbollah leader Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has stressed that the future challenge for the resistance group is liberating the Shebaa Farms and Farshuba Hills, which were occupied by Israel in 1967, as well as liberating Lebanon's natural resources, which have become part of bargaining efforts by the U.S. mediators. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Syria says it will consider any Turkish military incursion into its territory as a war crime and a crime against humanity. The foreign ministry issued the warning days after the Turkish president unveiled a plan to create safe zones beyond its southern borders to combat terror threats. In the past, Turkey has carried out several incursions, sending its forces into northern Syria under the pretext of fighting U.S.-backed Kurdish militants, the YPG. Damascus sees such incursions as violations of its sovereignty and territory. The Syrian Foreign Ministry has sent identical letters to the U.N. Secretary General and the Security Council, describing Turkey's actions as illegitimate. Meanwhile, Turkey has threatened to block NATO accession process of Sweden and Finland unless they address Ankara's security concerns.
We conveyed our message in very clear terms that the process will not move forward unless Turkey's security concerns are addressed through concrete steps and within a certain timetable.
The comment was made by Turkey's presidential spokesman following a meeting with Swedish and Finnish representatives in the Turkish capital. Ebrahim Kalin said the Nordic states told Turkey they understand its security concerns, adding, dialogue will continue. Stockholm and Helsinki launched their NATO accession bids last week. Support for their membership has soared following the Ukraine war. Turkey has opposed their membership over what it calls leniency toward Kurdish militant groups that it considers terrorist outfits. any NATO membership has to be unanimously approved by all NATO members. Ukraine's foreign minister has accused NATO of doing literally nothing in the face of Russia's military operation while praising the European Union's backing for Kiev. Dmitry Kuleba said that NATO is completely sidelined and is doing nothing to help Ukraine in this war with Russia. Kuleba, however, praised the EU for taking what he called revolutionary and groundbreaking decisions against Russia. Ukraine has been complaining over NATO's indecisive position on Kiev's accession into the military alliance. Russia strongly opposes Ukraine's membership into NATO. The EU has imposed a barrage of sanctions against Moscow since the start of the Ukraine war. EU member states are now mulling an oil embargo against Russia. And Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has dismissed suggestions that his country should give up territory and make concessions to end the war with Russia. Zelensky made the angry remarks in a video address to the World Economic Forum in Davos. He was reacting to a suggestion by former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger that Ukraine should let Russia keep Crimea, which it annexed in 2014. The New York Times editorial board also said last week that Ukraine may have to make some hard decisions to pave the way for a negotiated peace. Zelensky dismissed both suggestions, saying negotiations for a peace deal cannot resume until Russia withdraws its troops. Now, Zelensky has said that he'll only discuss an end to hostilities with Russian President Vladimir Putin and not via intermediaries. The British Prime Minister has been under fire for months over parties held in breach of COVID lockdown rules. After repeated denial and apology by Boris Johnson, an official report now blames him and his government for the party gate culture. We discussed this issue earlier with our guests in our news review program. Here it is.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. The British Prime Minister is in hot water again over COVID lockdown breaking parties. Long-awaited official report blames Boris Johnson and his government for the partygate culture. The report by Sue Gray, a senior civil servant, says the leadership and top officials must bear responsibility for violating COVID rules. The report probed 16 such events held at Whitehall and Downing Street while the country was placed under strict lockdown in 2020 at the height of the pandemic. Moments after the report was published, Johnson, addressing Parliament, said he takes full responsibility for what had happened.
And I want to begin today by renewing my apology to the House, to the whole country, for the short lunchtime gathering on the 19th of June 2020 in the Cabinet Room, during which I stood at my place at the Cabinet table and for which I received a fixed penalty notice. And I also want to say, Mr. Speaker, above all, that I take full responsibility for everything that took place on my watch.
The Premier also said that he was humbled and learned his lesson, but he insisted he was surprised and disappointed over drink-fueled events. That is while new revelations show Johnson himself attended a booze-filled party at his office, adding to the calls for him to resign. The opposition Labour Party leader has lashed out at the Prime Minister. Keir Starmer says the report would stand as a monument to the, quote, hubris and arrogance of Johnson's government. He censured the government for flouting the COVID lockdown rules. Rob Carter is a correspondent joining us from London to give us the latest, and we also have Lembit Opik, former UK Member of Parliament, joining us from London also. Welcome to you both, Rob Carter. So we've seen what the report's findings are, and we've seen the way Boris Johnson has reacted. Tell us about, or give us some highlights of that, and if you've had any chance to get some people's reactions on this.
Sure. Well, basically, Boris Johnson is in a very awkward position. There's no doubt about it. It's just the drip drip of these endless scandals really seem to be taking their toll now. Real pressure on the Prime Minister to basically resign as a result of these numerous parties, boozy parties that were conducted in Number 10, one of which, of course, was a birthday celebration. I think it was in June 2020. And this was a time when obviously the government was enforcing laws where the rest of us couldn't meet our friends and families, let alone do many other things. But of course, it seems as if it is very true that it's one rule for the rest of us and another totally for this government. So very, very difficult position that the Prime Minister finds himself in. And basically, after the recent presser that just ended just moments ago, where the Prime Minister took, I think it was just a number of questions, maybe about 9 questions or so, basically was refusing to, the point he was trying to make was that, look, he's apologized to the House and to the public, but ultimately he thinks that he could just be allowed to move on. And that's something which he hopes very much so will happen. But obviously his critics and the opposition are going to keep the spotlight on him and are going to pressure him, if not to resign, then to take some real meaningful measures to maybe hold some of his colleagues to account who were in attendance of those parties and some of which actually organized the Uzi event.
Lepidopic, so what do you think should be done in this case in point? I mean, obviously he says this has all happened under my watch, so I'm the one responsible. But I don't believe, at least your opinion matters here, that that suffice. So how should Boris Johnson, you think, proceed?
First of all, the dog in the street knows that he knew there were parties. Let's not pretend. He can sue me if he wants to on that one, and let's see how far he gets. Secondly, there's massive resentment from millions of people around the country, including potentially me, because my mother died last July, and I only saw her at the end of her life. I didn't get to see her physically for a year and a half because of the very lockdown rules that Boris Johnson and his colleagues seem to have broken. I would say specifically, number one, there's still an inquiry to happen in Parliament, and it would be astounding if they accepted this, in my view, lame belief that Boris Johnson could stand with a glass in his hand, surrounded by bottles and people, and didn't realize it was a party. The second thing is, if people feel like it, they could go and they could appeal against the crimes that they've been accused of on the basis that if they broke lockdown, they can say, well, the Prime Minister did worse, and he looks like he did it more than once. So why should we have this on our records whenever it turns out that the Prime Minister had done much more than that and got away with it?
Very well. Thank you for that. We appreciate it. Lepidopic there, former UK Member of Parliament. And Rob Carter, thank you, correspondent from London. And with that, we come to an end for this news review.
And that's a wrap for your latest, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. Goodbye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
UK ministers remain unable to decide on ways to relieve poverty as they wrangle over windfall tax for energy companies. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written jointly by Heather Stewart and Gwen Tufam under the heading Boris Johnson to stress work as the fix for cost of living crisis. Please stay with us to hear more about the story. UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson hopes to blunt calls for urgent action on the cost of living crisis by stressing that work is the best route out of poverty, as ministers continue wrangling about the merits of a windfall tax. Number 10 sources confirmed recently that the Prime Minister will continue to throw the spotlight on the healthy state of the job market in the face of the rising clamour to purportedly help families struggling with their bills. Ministers have as yet been unable to agree what more should be done to help, with Downing Street keen to stress £22 billion that has already been spent on supporting households and highlight the need to grow the economy. Johnson told the Welsh Conservative Conference on Friday, May 20th, "I'm proud to say that you have to go all the way back to 1974 to find a time when the unemployment was as low in the UK as it is today. And whatever the difficulties that the post-COVID economy faces now, I just want you to dwell on that for a second." However, with wages failing to keep up with 9% annual inflation, many of those struggling to make ends meet are already in jobs. Official figures show that 41% of universal credit claimants are in work, while the Joseph Rowntree Foundation calculates that 68% of families living in poverty include at least one working adult. The Liberal Democrats' economy spokesperson, Christine Jardine, said hardworking families across the UK are really struggling right now as the price of everything from food to fuel continues to rise. Yet the Conservatives are doing little to help. She said many people were juggling long hours and multiple jobs just to scrape by. With Parliament breaking for the Whitsun recess on Thursday, May 26, any fresh package of measures to help households cope with surging inflation is now not expected until June 6 at the earliest. The Treasury says the Chancellor Rishi Sunak is awaiting more details of how sharply energy bills are likely to rise in the autumn. Michael Lewis, the chief executive of E.ON, Britain's biggest energy supplier, said on Sunday, May 22, that 1 in 8 of its customers were already in arrears. Speaking on BBC One Sunday's morning show, Louis said, "I read emails from customers regularly, I listen in on calls, and frankly, some people are at the edge. They simply cannot pay, and that will get worse." The price cap for consumer bills had a record rise last month from £1,277 to £1,971 a year and is expected to rise to at least £2,600 in October, and Louis said it could even hit £3,000. He said it's a very, very significant impact. "That's why we've called upon the government to take more action. We do need more intervention in October, and it has to be very substantial." The former Treasury Minister Jess Norman became the latest senior Conservative to support a one-off levy on the profits of oil and gas firms on Sunday, May 22, claiming such a policy ethically principled and pragmatic. However, several cabinet ministers, including the business secretary Kwasi Kwarteng and the Brexit Opportunities Minister Jacob Rees-Mogg, have made clear their objections in public. Rees-Mogg warned against the idea that business was a honeypot that you can just raid whenever you feel like. In an unusual show of disunity, others, including the foreign secretary Liz Truss, have lodged a public plea for lower taxes. Truss said a low-tax economy was the way to tackle the crisis at a time when taxes have been rising. Sunak has not ruled out a windfall tax, which polling suggests would be popular with the public, insisting all options remain on the table. It is understood one proposal under consideration is a taper tax that would fall less heavily on firms that invest, though number 10 sources suggested it had not yet been discussed with the Prime Minister. Johnson and Sunak have been meeting regularly to thrash out a set of policies, but have not yet decided whether to stick to the targeted measures to help the poorest families or include costlier across-the-board proposals. These could include a value-added tax, VAT cut, or bringing forward the income tax cut that Sunak has planned for 2024. Ministers have consistently struggled to respond to the question of what more the UK government will do to supposedly help households, after the Chancellor's spring statement was widely regarded as inadequate. A string of Tory backbenchers from across the party have called on the government to do more, including Northern Research Group Chair Jake Berry, the Committee Chair Bernard Jenkin, and the Education Committee Chair Robert Halfen.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
A Muslim lady.
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear listeners. Thank you so very much for joining us on today's fresh episode of Muslim Lady. In the studio, I have the honor and privilege of being joined by my sister in faith and humanity and a special guest, Sister Razia Shamli. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, my dear sister.
We've been talking a few times in our show about plastic surgery.
In women, we've talked about.
Oh, we talked about it. Oh, so today we want to talk about plastic surgery specified to men.
Yeah.
Because we talked about women.
Yeah.
And their plastic surgery.
We didn't
surgery.
Really talk about women either. Men do not have this problem as much as women
yes,
do.
Yes, that's exactly what I wanted to say. Men honestly aren't that self-conscious about themselves as women are.
You know?
And that's why they're not targeted as much either. And enterprises and corporations haven't been able to feed on this insecurity as much as it's been able to do with women.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why cosmetics are targeting women,
yeah.
Plastic surgery, fashion, all of these things are targeting women because women are more self-conscious about their appearance rather than men.
Yeah, that is true. As I said, one of the reasons that women have this addiction to the social media, is like I was looking at this really nice debate between two guys on YouTube, and he was like, when a woman she has her Instagram, she's a teen, she's 17 and she has an Instagram page and she's just posting, you know, from time to time her daily life. And then she goes on a vacation and she starts posting one picture of herself in a bikini, exposing her skin. And that's when like an explosion happens. Likes, new followers. And she goes into the explore. And she gets reward for what she's doing. Exactly. So one action, a lot of reward.
Mm.
Another action. Then she says she goes, like, if she goes on that trip, on a trip once a year, then that reward that she got from all these likes and all this acceptance, even the, you know, the really beautiful girls, they say, oh, nice look, you know, I love like what you're wearing, or I love like how
your
this
pose,
part of
your body,
looks,
whatever,
right?
Yeah.
That approval, that sense of approval that she gets reinforces in her and motivates her to go on another vacation very soon and more videos and pictures exposing her body. And then it just turns into, it makes a new personality out of her.
But then here's the thing. I'm thinking if the dude was just as ripped, right, and fit as beautiful 17-year-old girl or whatever, he would get a lot of acknowledgement on social media as well, right? Number one, if the girl wasn't so beautiful and fit, she would still get a degree, but a lower degree of acknowledgement. But it would be more in the tone of, it would be more of like a political nuance to it. They would try to be proving a point by acknowledging her.
That even if you're not perfect, you're still beautiful.
Yes, but they don't do it for men.
Things.
Yeah, exactly. See, that's what it, and I think that's why the Quran, when it talks about how men and women should be presenting themselves in society, when the Holy Book addresses women, it says, cover yourselves up, number one, and don't flaunt yourselves. Because mm-hmm. the Quran knew this is an innate quality of women. Mm-hmm. They like to be noticed.
Which verse are you talking about?
When it talks about tabarruj, mm-hmm. flaunting themselves, displaying themselves. Because women like to be noticed and praised for
exactly.
their beauty.
The idea
Men,
of acceptance.
Meh, right? But for women, that's just like wonderful for them.
Yeah, that's true. But at the same time, so many things are changing. Although when you're comparing psychologically a girl with a boy, a man with a woman, and of course that need for acceptance is so much higher for a girl. I mean, to be seen as a beautiful girl and to be loved and cherished and to be paid attention. Compared to boy, they don't need these things, really.
They need it in another aspect, yeah.
They need it in other aspects. But I think the norms or the social media is creating needs for the boys
totally.
These days. That
it's just
look,
like capitalism, consumerism.
Exactly, that you have to look, you have to be fit. You have to have six packs. You have to have like certain measure like of chin or like there are standards, bodily standards for men too these days.
Obviously.
And I'm saying that they are fitting them into the boys' brains.
Is it necessarily a bad thing though? If it boosts relationships, if it boosts confidence, if it makes you overall healthier and what's wrong with it?
The problem is that it's not boosting their things. It's turning into many hours in a day of going to the gym and injecting certain hormones to their
bodies.
Yeah,
that's why we talked about balance in the
there
beginning
is
of
no
the
balance.
Show. No, that's their problem.
There is no
it
balance.
It doesn't necessarily mean aestheticism and aspiring for beauty is necessarily a wrong thing. John? You are listening to Muslim Lady while we are discussing the interesting topic of plastic surgery and how it applies on the two genders. We're going to be back after a short break, so stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Welcome back, sisters, brothers, ladies, gentlemen. This is Muslim Lady from IRIB English Radio.
Like, remember a couple of months ago, we were talking about self-care? And we talked about how the Prophet used to use kohl, perfume, how he used to clean his garments, how he used to, even he had certain handkerchiefs. He used to wipe, you know, we had wet wipes with the scent of saffron and other like natural fragrances, and how he combed his hair, how he looked at himself in the mirror, how he was careful to use, to remove, you know, extra hair from his body, how he cared to be very attractive for his wives, how he, you know, used henna. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a beautiful hadith that what are the benefits of henna and this and that. We did talk about that.
I remember.
Is the balance.
Yeah.
Not the six packs.
What's wrong with six packs?
If you're injecting,
if you just get natural six packs,
if you're
through
a doctor,
diet and hard work,
if you're a father of three children, and if you're a busy working man, and if you can, is it possible for you to have to develop six packs and to have all these responsibilities? The six packs are single guys who don't have any families to take care of.
All right, good for them.
Yeah,
I mean, all of these things, even beauty for women, it. it is redefined through different stages of her life,
mm-hmm.
you know? Some things that look beautiful on a teen or a woman in her early 20s cannot be pulled off by a more mature woman. Their style, their fashion, their color choices, even their makeup application changes through the stages of their lives. And it's the same thing for men. At a certain stage, when you're in your early 20s, you're a bachelor, you've got no responsibilities, all you do is hit the books and hit the gym, hey, enjoy your six-pack. And then after a while, you get a little older, you settle down, you have kids, you enjoy the dad bod.
It's becoming a trend these days. Like back like 20 years ago, to have to develop six-pack, it was the job of a very small minority in the society where they were bodybuilders.
Yeah.
Nowadays, many men, like average men, they are tending towards six-packs because...
Wait. Is it hindering their performance in other fields of life?
You know, these days, there is less tendency towards marriage. And obviously, there's more time. They're bachelors.
Uh-huh.
And these bachelors need to continue looking handsome and attractive because they want to have a partner. They want to find a girlfriend.
Okay, then that's just evolution.
No, it's not a good evolution. You know, what I'm just trying to say is that one of the reasons that there is a lot of more plastic surgery these days
uh-huh.
is because there are so many more single men because they're not in any relationship. And
where are all the women then?
No. The women are also they have their own story. Let's not open their story.
Mm-hmm.
Now we're just talking about men. So men are tending more towards plastic surgery because, look, if you're in your early 20s and you get married, you get settled, your six pack would be your number 10 priority in life.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're in your middle 30s and you're still single, your six packs would be your number 2 priority.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm getting? I'm just saying that because they are not in permanent relationships, because there is no family,
mm-hmm.
these men, they always have to look fresh, sexy, attractive. So they have to have these,
work on themselves.
But as you enter into the relationship, as you said, you enter into the different phases of your life. A physical attraction always will remain something very important until the end of your life, but it will lower down in terms of priority. It will not be your second priority. It will be your fifth priority. And this is my understanding. This is my analysis of why men are tending, opting towards...
plastic surgery?
No, plastic surgery and body fitness.
Mm-hmm.
The way like working like on your six packs. One reason that why men are opting more towards certain physical features, like growing a six-pack, developing a six-pack, is because, as you said, like in the nature of video games, you have to overcome something, like it's a process, and you have to conquer it. And like it's an aim that they have to pursue, and the reward is great, because the way it has been displayed among the other sex is that, like, if a man has a six-pack, it looks very attractive to a woman.
Mm.
And it's not a difficult thing to obtain. So he goes, after developing it, he spends 6 months on it, and there he goes with a six-pack.
Obviously, and this doesn't apply to all men, but this is one way to look at it. Right. That because some men literally they have a stable partner. Them and their partner are into the healthy lifestyle
mm-hmm.
and bodybuilding. You know,
mm-hmm.
they're not competitive bodybuilders, but that's their method of exercising.
Mm-hmm.
There's that, and then there's like dudes who are just looking to pick up women with their abs. You know, when it comes to that, it doesn't matter whether it's abs or a car or a new haircut or whatever. That is like, I feel it's an uncool motif for a man to develop, no matter...
It's an uncool motif.
It's an uncool motif for a man to develop an asset, no matter what that asset is. To pick up women? That's ridiculous.
To develop six-pack because of a woman.
Or whatever else. Or like buy an expensive car or whatever. That's all the time we have. This was a more complicated topic than I anticipated. And obviously, we're going to have to talk about it more. You can join us on future episodes of Muslim Lady. Until then, I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Who is the lover? Allah. Who is Ar-Rahman? Allah. Who is Al-Mannan? La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. Allah is our return. The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. La ilaha illallah. Muhammadur Rasulullah. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah. Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men. Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female and made us into nations and tribes so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other. Chapter 49, verse 13. La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return. The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men and has commended them greatly. Chapter 3, verse 37.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The shock came midway through the speech. Reparation, boomed Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Haiti's firebrand president, to the cheers of farmers, workers, students who had gathered in the crowd. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Constant Mahout, Catherine Porter, Salam Gebrekidan, and Matt Apuzzo. The piece is titled A Haitian president tried to hold France to account for its years of exploitation. He soon found himself ousted from power. The shock came midway through the speech. Reparation boomed Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Haiti's firebrand president, to the cheers of the farmers, workers and students who had gathered in the crowd. The French ambassador to Haiti, sitting on stage, hid his alarm behind an awkward smile. He knew Mr. Aristide well enough to expect barbs at Haiti's former French colonizers and slave masters. But on that day, on 7th of April 2003, the president suddenly started calling for reparations, a bombshell that became a hallmark of his presidency, and diplomats now concede part of his undoing. We had to try to defuse it, the French ambassador to Haiti, Yves Goudil, said of Mr. Aristide's call for reparations, calling it an explosive. With his remarks, Jean-Bertrand Aristide tried to excavate a history that remains all but buried in France. Long after Haitians threw off their shackles, beat Napoleon's forces, and won their independence 2 centuries ago, France came back with warships and an unheard-of demand that the people of Haiti pay astounding amounts of money to their former slave masters or face war again. Haiti became the first and only nation in the world to pay reparations to its former slave masters and their descendants for generations. According to a New York Times analysis of thousands of pages of archival documents, it shipped the equivalent of hundreds of millions of dollars to France, setting off a cycle of perpetual debt that sapped Haiti's ability to build a nation for more than 100 years. Yet, to this day, that history is not taught in French schools, and many of the country's most prominent aristocratic families are unaware that their ancestors kept collecting payments from Haiti's poorest people long after the end of slavery in Haiti. Jean-Bertrand Aristide, Haiti's first democratically elected president after decades of dictatorship, wanted France to do far more than acknowledge its past. He wanted restitutions from Paris. What beautiful schools, universities and hospitals we'll be able to build for our children, he told the crowd. How much food we will have in abundance. The consequences were immediate and lasting. In interviews, a dozen French and Haitian political figures recounted how a worried France worked quickly and doggedly to stifle Jean-Bertrand Aristide's call for reparations before siding with his opponents and collaborating with the United States to remove Aristide from power. France and the United States have long said that Jean-Bertrand Aristide's call for restitution had nothing to do with his ouster, that he had taken an autocratic turn, lost control of the country, and was spirited into exile to prevent Haiti, already heaving with turmoil, from careening into chaos. But France's ambassador to Haiti at the time, Thierry Burkhard, conceded in an interview that France and the United States had effectively orchestrated a coup d'etat against Jean-Bertrand Aristide, and that his abrupt removal from power was probably a bit about his call for reparations from France as well. It made our job easier to dismiss the reparations claim without Jean-Bertrand Aristide in office, Thierry Burkhard noted. The showdown underscores how, 2 centuries after France forced the Haitians to pay their former slave masters for the liberty they had already won in battle, the effects continue to ripple through the politics of both countries. By calling for restitution, Haiti, a nation born from what historians called the world's most successful slave rebellion, struck at France's national identity as a beacon of human rights and threatened to inspire other nations with historical grievances against France to follow its lead. Nations in the Caribbean and in Africa. "We were very disdainful of Haiti," the French ambassador Yves Godwell recalled. "What I think we will never forgive Haiti for, deep down, is that it is the country that beat us." Even after Jean-Bertrand Aristide's removal of power in 2004, the calls for restitution have continued to reverberate, leading to a stunning concession more than a decade later by François Hollande, France's former president, who referred to the money Haiti was forced to hand over as ransom of independence. Since then, scholars have increasingly explored the history of Haiti's payments. Just this past December, at a conference on the grounds of the French Finance Ministry, one of the most prominent French historians on relations between the two countries, Jean-François Brière, called the payments a form of meta-slavery that prevented Haiti from breaking free of France long after independence. "All French people are affected by the nation's past in Haiti," said Jean-Marc Ayrault, a former French prime minister. Yet, Ayrault said, French students don't learn about it and few officials discuss it. "It's never taught in France," he said. "It's never explained." Mr. Yves Godwell, France's former ambassador to Haiti, wanted to negotiate. Jean-Bertrand Aristide's sudden call for restitution was a political hand grenade, he feared, threatening to embarrass France on the world stage and rip apart relations between the two countries. Yet, Jean-Bertrand Aristide's stance was not unreasonable, he recalled thinking. He wasn't wrong to say how much harm it had done to his country, Mr. Goodwill said of France's history in Haiti, and to ask France for compensation in turn. The former French ambassador to Haiti, Yves Goodwill, said he urged the French government at the time to open discussions with Haiti to help defuse the situation, but was firmly rejected. "I didn't understand how we could be so stupid," Mr. Goodwill said. Jean-Bertrand Aristide, a polarizing figure who rose to office as a champion of the poor, knew his campaign was contentious and had timed it for maximal impact. He announced his demand on the 200th anniversary of the death of Toussaint Louverture, the Haitian revolutionary leader seized by Napoleon Bonaparte's forces and carted off to prison in France, where he died without a trial. "Why, after 200 years, is Haiti this impoverished?" Jean-Bertrand Aristide said in a recent interview at his home in a suburb of Haiti's capital, Port-au-Prince. One of the reasons, he said, was the enormous amount of money that Haiti had been forced to hand over to France for generations, a heavy burden often called the independence debt. Mr. Aristide uncovered this history only after he had already been ousted from office the first time, his aide said, when a military coup d'etat deposed him in 1991 and forced him into exile in the United States. He began immersing himself in the growing scholarship on a history that even as Haiti's president, he knew little about. After the Americans helped restore him to power, he was re-elected in 2000 and intensified his research into Haiti's past. He would call many times, asking for more information, recalled Dr. Francis Saint-Hubert, a Haitian physician who had studied the links between the abysmal state of public health in Haiti and the money siphoned off by France. On the bicentennial anniversary, Jean-Bertrand Aristide upped the political ante by declaring the precise amount he said France owed Haiti. 21 billion, 685 million, $135,571. French diplomats and some Haitians mocked the multi-billion dollar figure as a misguided publicity stunt by a demagogue trying to maintain his grip on power. A group of 130 Haitian intellectuals denounced the restitution campaign as a desperate attempt to distract attention from the Jean-Bertrand Aristide government's totalitarian drift, incompetence and corruption. A French foreign ministry spokesman said France did not need to take lessons from Haiti's leaders. But a New York Times analysis of the long-term damage done by sending enormous sums of money to France shows that Haiti's losses may have been surprisingly close to Jean-Bertrand Aristide's figure of $21.68 billion. In fact, his estimate may have been a bit modest. The New York Times scoured thousands of pages of archival government documents to determine how much Haiti sent to France over the course of generations, not just in official payments to former slaveholders, but also for a loan to help pay them. The New York Times found that Haiti paid France a total of $560 million in today's dollars. But that only begins to account for the loss. With the help of 15 leading economists from around the world, we modeled what might have happened if that money had gone into the Haitian economy, rather than being siphoned off to France without getting any goods or any services in return. The New York Times' estimates found that over time, the payments to France cost Haiti from $21 billion to $115 billion in lost economic growth. Put in perspective, that is anywhere from 1 to 8 times the size of Haiti's entire economy in 2020. "We were building a path to the truth," Jean-Bertrand Aristide said in the interview, without being told the outcome of the New York Times' analysis.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.